Good morning, everybody. Boker Tov, and welcome. Birshus Rabbi Wein, who is with us here today. I'm not sure there's anything at all that I could possibly have to say that he wouldn't be able to say more deeply, broadly, and infinitely better. But nevertheless, it's a schus, and it's always wonderful to have Rabbi Wein here. Maybe I've done this before, but I'll do it again. I just want to take this opportunity to publicly thank Rabbi Wein for his assistance, aitzah, advice, general support when my wife and myself were thinking about making Aliyah. 15 years ago already now, Rabbi Wein was unbelievably supportive and gave us some very useful advice. And whilst it was wonderful, Baruch Hashem, to come to Israel, for me and my wife, for my children, it was life transformative on a level that we could never have imagined then, and in a wonderful way. And therefore, any schus that they have to a large degree is down to him. So thank you on behalf of Sarah and myself for those wonderful words. Now, Rav Yaakov Emden, we spoke last week about the Chacham Tzvi. Originally, I planned, naively, to talk about the Chacham Tzvi and Rav Yaakov Emden in the same shir. But as I got more into the Chacham Tzvi, I realized that he deserved his own shir. And Rav Yaakov Emden for sure deserves his own share. And unfortunately, the slight casualty was the Chida, who I wanted to speak about today, who Be'ezat Hashem on a future occasion will have opportunity to discuss, a fascinating figure from the Sephardi world, living at the same time as the Vilna Gaon, a very seasoned traveler, with lots of very important things to add in terms of the halakhic literature. But we can't talk about everything all in one go, so we'll talk about Rav Yaakov Emden. A couple of people mentioned last week they were descendants of Rav Yaakov Emden, which is a big schos. I hope that after we finish today's share, they still feel that it's a big schos to be descendant from Rav Yaakov Emden. It is, believe me, but it's not zelo davar pashut. Rav Yaakov Emden described himself as Kanai ben Kanai, which was, it's not a quote directly from him, it's from the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which was about Pinchas, etc. But it was a wonderful epithet to use for himself, because he was indeed the son of his father. He didn't always have the same views as his father, and I'm not getting into all of the halakhic details today, but interestingly, on one small nugget, whereas the Chacham Tzvi himself is very famous for the psak that we looked at inside last week, that all visitors to Eretz Yisrael, even for a short time, should be keeping one day of Yom Tov. Rabbi Yaakov Emden himself actually paskened the exact opposite. He ruled that all people living in Israel should be keeping 2 days of Yom Tov. He quotes his father, and he disagrees with him, because he holds that all the reasons to keep 2 days Yom Tov apply just as much in Eretz Israel as they do in Chutz La'aretz, and therefore his psak was for the Israelis to keep 2 days of Yom Tov, something which, as you well know, didn't catch on. Funny, isn't it? The Chacham Tzvi psak did catch on, but Rabbi Yaakov Emden's didn't. So there are many things to say, and we said a lot about the Chacham Tzvi last week, but I'd like to speak about Rav Yaakov Emden today. There is so much Torah that one could give from Rav Yaakov Emden, from the Shailas and Tshuvas Yaivetz. He has such a lot of important things to add in the halakhic world. It's hard to know where to begin. And it's a temptation which I, to a large degree, succumb to talk about the more controversial parts of his life. But it must be said, and it mustn't be forgotten, that he wrote vast amounts of classic halakhic literature on many other very standard areas of life. We'll look at a few things today, but most of what I'd like to pick out today are the things that everybody knows him for his controversial position, because they're very interesting and they have a lot to say about him and his life. I really want to deal with 7 issues today. We'll talk a little bit at the beginning about a biography. I assume you know pretty much about Rav Yaakov Emden's life, but we'll talk about some of the basic outline issues. I'd like to talk about 7 controversial things that he said or did. I'd like to talk about his ban on the Ramchal of Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, which was eclipsed to some degree later by his controversial relationship with Rav Yonatan Eibeshitz, which I want to talk about in a second. I'd like to talk about his views on the Zohar, which I think are well known but need to be repeated. His views on the Morin Nevuchim, which are less well known, but fascinating, especially in the light of his views on philosophy generally. Then I want to talk about his views on Christianity. I just gave a share just now about the OU Israel Center, dealing with Nittelnacht and the Christianity's connections with Saturnalia and all sorts of things like that. So there's a connection there, but the Chacham Tzvi, the Rav Yaakov Emden has some unusual views on Christianity which he published. Then I want to talk a little bit about his views on marriage and sexuality, and finally about his autobiography. Believe it or not, we'll get this done in 55 minutes, don't worry. I'm not going to keep you till 4 o'clock, but let's get into it and see where it takes us. Rav Yaakov Emden, known Emden because of his short stay in the Rabbanut in Emden, which we'll talk about soon, but unlike his father, he really didn't travel around that much compared to the Chacham Tzvi, and he didn't have many rabbinic posts. As you know, because we talked about this 2 weeks ago when we talked about the Taz and the Shach, Shabtai Tzvi died in 1676, but his movement was kept alive by his sidekick, Nathan of Gaza, who himself died a few years later. But there was an underground movement of Sabbateans, which continued then and continues to this day. There are still Sabbateans around. I mentioned that I met one once in Hebron who asked for my help because he was having trouble with the Rabbanut, because he had a strange conversion and they weren't very happy that he was a Sabbatean. And could I help him? Why exactly he picked on poor little me walking into Maratha Machpelah, I've no idea. But my answer to him was no, I couldn't help him. But there are people around. The Chacham Tzvi himself was born, the Rabbi Yaakov Emden rather, was born in Altona when the Chacham Tzvi was in Altona. Then it was in Denmark. Subsequently, it's in the area of Schleswig-Holstein in northern Germany. He studied mostly, he didn't have a classic yeshiva education. He was homeschooled most of his life by his father. And his father's life, as we talked about last week, was very, there was a lot of upheaval. So that clearly had an impact on his own education. But he became a prolific writer, Talmudist and Kabbalist. He married a few times. He married, first of all, the daughter of the Rav of Brod in Moravia. He studied his father's law yeshiva. He had a very rocky relationship with his father-in-law, which he talks about in his autobiography, which we'll talk about a bit at the end. He claims that his father-in-law stole some of his wedding presents. He says that, which, you know, as a father-in-law, there's often some issues going on there with sons-in-law, fathers-in-law. He talks about the incessant arguing that he had with his wife in the early days of marriage. When we get to his autobiography, we'll see that he doesn't leave anything unsaid. It's an unbelievably personal, graphic account of his life. We'll talk about that later. So he married. He had various children. Some of his children, as was not uncommon then, died young. But he became a jewelry dealer. He had to make money. His father and his mother died in close succession. Chacham Tzvi and his wife died soon after each other. He worked like his father worked in jewelry, and he declined to take a rabbinic post. Like his father, he felt that if he wasn't being paid by the Kehillah, he would have freedom to say whatever he wants. That proved to be very true. In addition to his father's achievements, he managed to get permission from the King of Denmark to have his own private printing press in Altona, and he went on to print many Sfarim, which of course he was now the master of his own house, including the Siddur. His Siddur is very important, the Siddur of the Yaivet, which has a lot of extensive notes, which we'll talk a little bit about that soon. And he waged war through his wife on the Sabbateans, the Neo-Sabbateans, and their practical Kabbalah. We'll talk more about that when we talk about Rav Yaakov Emden himself was a Kabbalist, although Rav Eibeschitz's camp claims that he wasn't anything like as good a Kabbalist as Rav Eibeschitz was. That's not something that I can pass any judgment on, but certainly Rav Emden was an extremely advanced Talmud Chacham in Kabbalah as well. He joined the opposition to the young Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzer, we'll talk about that, and then to Rav Eibeschitz himself. In 1751, Rav Eibeschitz was appointed chief rabbi of Kehillat Ahu. We talked about Kehillat Ahu last week, Altona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek. This, of course, was the Kehillah that Rav Emden's father was the previous rav of, two ravs before. Rav Yaakov Emden definitely felt that that Kehillah should have gone to him. There's no question about it. He felt somehow it was part of his Yerusha, and he had a very negative attitude to most of the Rabbonim who occupied that post after his father. We'll see Rabbi Cheskel, Katzen Ellenbogen, and also Rav Eibeschitz we'll talk about in a minute. In his later life, he had an interesting personal connection with Moses Mendelssohn. There's a whole correspondence between him and Moses Mendelssohn. One interesting issue that came up at the end of his life is that the Duke of Mecklenburg, Schwerin, issued a decree prohibiting burial on the same day as the person died. As you know, people were very worried in those days that if you died, you may not actually be dead. and they'd bury you, and it was too late. And therefore, they had all these contraptions, little bells that you could, you know, from inside the coffin that you could ring. You can see pictures of these things. People were very concerned about this, that they shouldn't be buried when they were not yet dead. And the Duke passed a law, as you would imagine people would be concerned, the Duke passed the law that no one can be buried on the day of death. The local Jewish community appealed to Rabbi Yaakov Emden, then a very elder statesman in the Jewish world, to please influence the Duke and persuade him that for Jewish people this is not acceptable. Rav Emden wrote back and said, look, you know, I can do this, but the best person to do this is Moses Mendelssohn. He has an in with the local government, and he is someone who can represent you. It turned out that Mendelssohn actually said he agreed with the Duke that people should not be buried on the same day that they died, which didn't really help very much. And Rav Yaakov Emden then writes to Moses Mendelssohn and says, look, you know, I thought you were going to help out here. Actually, you now need to justify that you're religious in your own right, because people are now speaking about you. And then, of course, Moses Mendelssohn is a whole life unto himself, and we're not going to talk about it even more. Finally, Rabbi Emden died. He died on a Friday afternoon, which was important, because they didn't have anything prepared. It was nearly Shabbos, and they had to bury him in the grave that was already available, and he ended up, therefore, being buried just a few graves away from Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz, his nemesis. And there's a picture there of the Jewish cemetery in Altona. I haven't been there. Maybe Rabbi Wein has been there. Have you been there, Rabbi Wein, to Altona? But some people may have been there in Altona. You can visit the grave, and the two of them are buried very close together. That was a very quick whistle-stop tour across his life. He wasn't 100 years old. Isaac was 100 years old. He was 80-something years, 1697 to 1776. He was in his late 70s, which was quite an age in those days. The Eibeshitz died a few years before him. In terms of his Torah writings, he wrote very prolifically, whereas with the Chacham Tzvi, really everything we saw last week was from the Shalish and Tshuvas of the Chacham Tzvi. Rav Emden wrote extensively on many issues. Some of his writing dealt with the alleged heresy of Rabbi Eibeshitz. I brought you a few of some of the Sfarim at the top, the Eidus B'Yaakov and the Shvirus Luchas Ha'aven. He also wrote a sefer we'll be quoting from later called Mitpachat Sfarim, where he dealt with his views on the Zohar. The most famous things he wrote perhaps were his Shailas Yaivetz, 372 responsa across the range of halachic issues, his Siddur, which is, I have in my house, it's well worth reading, has some beautiful commentary on different things, grammatical notes, ritual laws, a lot on Friday night issues, which we'll talk about later, and then his Moru Ketzia. Moru Ketzia is his Chidushim on Shulchan Aruch, which we can buy, and finally his Megillah Sefer, which was just brought out in English. I actually have a copy of it here in translation in English. It's not a desperately good English translation, and the reviews have been pretty poor, but nevertheless it's what we have, and if you're interested in reading his own autobiography, which we'll touch on at the end, you can get it from Amazon for about, you know, $35-$40, and it's even though it may not be the best translation, it's a riveting read and a page turner just because of the content of the book, and therefore I recommend it strongly for those who are interested in this. Fine. Let's start off in terms of quotations. Most of today's quotes are in English. I apologize if you wanted more Hebrew. Last week everything was in Hebrew. Today a lot of it's in different kinds of translations or originally in English from different places. I'd like to start off with a quote from Rabbi J.J. Schechter. Rabbi Schechter wrote his PhD thesis in 1988 in Harvard on the life of Rabbi Yaakov Emden. And it's a 700 and something page thesis, which I was desperate to get my hands on, and actually managed to persuade Rabbi Schechter. I actually taught his granddaughter last year in seminary, which probably helped a little bit. And he sent me this monstrous PhD thesis, which I now have and started to read, but I only got it yesterday. So I didn't get a chance to actually read all 700 pages. But I did get a chance to flick through it, and I wanted to bring one paragraph at the beginning, which I think tells us a lot about the life of Rabbi Yaakov Emden. Look at number one. Rav Schechter writes as follows. He was intensely curious about all forms of general knowledge, including history, geography, science, astronomy, nature, medicine, other religions, and foreign languages. His works contained references to surgery, alchemy, shooting stars, crocodiles, opium, the game of chess, a microscope, volcanoes, magnets, solar eclipse, cannon, and hot water bottles. He had some familiarity with Greek and Italian, quoted Aristotle, Avicenna, Jesus, and even Confucius. In his halacha works, he discussed such diverse topics as the nature of sound, the importance of sleep and exercise, the process of making vinegar, how to pull a tooth, the width of the Jordan River, the pleasures and physical as well as psychological benefits of sex. He claimed it was a cure for insanity. You can read there. Why it is the head of a baby which emerges first from the womb, the importance of perspiration, why fire rises, the relative merits of various laxatives, how wine is prepared along the Rhine River, different types of tools and soaps, the direction in which goldenrod grew, I had to look that up, it's a kind of flower, and more. Unfettered by the discipline of a formal yeshiva background, his intellectual curiosity knew no bounds. Which is an interesting little dig at the end, but I thought that was a wonderful overview. What's that? Nobody stopped him. Nobody could stop him. That was his executive. So I thought that was a very good initial overview. You get a little bit of an insight into his life. Let's talk about those seven controversial issues that I mentioned before that I was going to talk about. First of all, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzer. The Ramchal is now, in retrospect, one of the Jewish heroes in Torah of the 1700s. But if you'd have asked anybody to predict back in the 1700s whether that would be the case, very few people would have done that, because his life was extremely difficult. We're not here to talk about the Ramchal in detail, but I need to mention a few things about him just to bring in Rav Yaakov Emden. The Ramchal was born, of course, in Italy, and he received a classic Jewish-Italian education, expert in Tanakh, Talmud, non-Jewish arts, etc. Very charismatic, even at a very young age, very into Hebrew language, linguistic style, very innovative. Aged 14 already, he was said to have mastered many of the Kabbalistic issues of the Arizal, and he set up this small group of mystics called the Mevakshei Hashem, who learned Zohar, B'toranut, around 24/7. They were all learning Zohar. He began to receive voices, lessons from a Maggid, which is not unusual. Rav Yosef Karo, we spoke about in previous Shi'urim, wrote Maggid Meisharim, also had a Maggid, but he was a little bit older than Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzer, and he began to receive lessons from a Maggid. He wrote thousands of pages of mysticism, revealed by the Maggid, Gilu Eliyahu, etc. One of his students actually published, as he was, the Ramchal was writing his new Zohar, he wrote the second Zohar, which you can buy. It's Zohar Chadash, if you like, the Zohar Sheni that the Ramchal composed. One of his students, if you flip over the page, described what it was like learning with the Ramchal at that time. He writes, There is here a holy man, my master and teacher, the holy lamp, the lamp of God, his honor, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzer. For these past 2.5 years, a maggid has been revealed to him, a holy, tremendous angel, who reveals wondrous mysteries to him. With the approval of the Holy One, blessed be he, and his Shechina, the maggid ordered him to compose the Book of the Zohar, called in heaven the second Zohar, I mentioned just now. The angel speaks out of his mouth, but we, his disciples, hear nothing. The angel begins to reveal to him mysteries. Then the master orders Eliyahu to come to him, and he comes to impart mysteries of his own. Sometimes Metatron, the great prince, one of the Malachim, an angel comes to him, as well as the faithful shepherd Moshe, the patriarch Abraham, Rav Hamnuna the elder, Ahu Saba, the old man, and sometimes King Messiah himself and Adam Harishon. To some of nothing is hidden from him. At first, permission was only granted to reveal to him the mysteries of the Torah, but now all things are revealed to him. No one outside our circle knows of it. He has demonstrated to all. No one before him had this kind of merit since the time of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Now, that's a very impressive range of chavrusas to have as a young man, okay? And he obviously attracted the attention of people who were very worried that this might turn into a whole new Shabtai Tzvi debacle. Yes. Ahu Saba in the Gemara is usually a reference to Eliyahu Novi. Ahu Saba. Okay? This raised concerns. Rav Moshe Hagid, that we remember from last week, which was one of the Chaverim of Rav, of the Chacham Tzvi. Rav Moshe Hagid campaigned against the Ramchal. He was also opposed by the religious establishment there, who were again very nervous that he would be a new Shabtai Tzvi. He was threatened with Cherem, but he was able to come to accommodation, etc. To cut a long story short, he left Italy, he wandered around, he went to Frankfurt am Main. They also made him sign a document that he was not going to be a Kabbalist anymore. He was forced to take certain oaths. They destroyed his writings. Rav Yaakov Emden discovered Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzer and also felt very opposed to him. Apart from anything else, the Ramchal didn't wear rabbinic clothes. He didn't have a beard. He wrote poetry and plays. There are dramas. which were written religious dramas by the Ramchal. Rabbi Yaakov Emden led a public opposition to him and basically ran him out of town. He went to Amsterdam, then moved to Eretz Yisrael, where he died at an early age of 39. Rabbi Yaakov Emden felt strongly about this. This was an early, if you like, version of his opposition to Rabbi Yonatan Eibeshitz. But after the Ramchal died, he gave a kind of quasi-apology. Rabbi Yaakov Emden writes here in number 3, "I am willing to accept truth from any source, even if it be from the smallest of the small. And if the only sin of the Ramchal was in revealing secrets told to him by a heavenly voice, may my share be like his share. And the mere fact that he was yet so young and not married when learning Kabbalah is a slight transgression on his part. Nevertheless, no intentional persecution was brought upon him." Well, maybe not by Rabbi Yaakov Emden, but by other people. That's a sort of half apology. The fact is that the Ramchal became, in retrospect, a great figure in the Jewish people. Why was that? Because basically everybody adopted him. The Vilna Gaon said he would have walked on his hands and knees to meet the Ramchal if he could have done so. That was rehabilitation in the yeshiva world. The Hasidim definitely connected with the Ramchal very, very strongly as a proto-Hasidic thinker. The Maggid of Meserich wrote about him. His generation didn't merit the great man. Many among our people, through lack of knowledge, have uttered to this on this saintly man calumny that was not justified. And also in the Haskalah world, the Ramchal was accepted as a leader in Jewish literature, in prose, in poetry, as I said, in drama as well. And therefore, looking back, the Ramchal was a very, very major player in Jewish terms of the 1700s. But again, you would never have thought that at the time. You would never have predicted that. And Rav Yaakov Emden was nervous, let's not say entirely in opposition, in the way that he became to Rav Yonatan Eibeshitz, but was very nervous about the Ramchal and came out against him, although, as I said later, he went back on that a little bit. Let's talk about Rav Yonatan Eibeshitz a little bit before we move into some more Makairos. Here is a well-known picture of Rav Yonatan Eibeshitz. He was born in Poland. He was a touch older than Rav Yaakov Emden. He studied in some classic places, in Prozenice, in Holoshau. He married and went to live in Hamburg. He became the head of yeshiva in Prague and was held in very high esteem. And this is an important point. When the Chacham Tzvi, Rav Emden's father, went out guns blazing against Rav Nechemia Chayun back in Amsterdam earlier on, Nechemia Chayun was an itinerant preacher. He didn't really have a track record. He didn't really have many supporters. And when Rav Yosef Eibeshitz basically, when Chacham Tzvi, hunted him down in Amsterdam many years before, it was not hard really to succeed against him. However, Rav Yonatan Eibeshitz was a very different kettle of fish. He was an established rabbinic figure, a major Talmud Chacham with enormous amounts of support in the European rabbinate. And therefore to take on Rav Yonatan Eibeshitz was an entirely different thing than his father had done with Rav Nechemia Chayun. Yes. What are the Sabbateans? So we talked about this 2 weeks ago. The Sabbateans were a group of people who kept alive the thinking and teachings of Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi, the name Sabbatean from Shabtai. Shabtai Tzvi died, as we saw before, in the late 1600s. And he, in the 1660s, caused this, we talked about this in length 2 weeks ago, this incredible upheaval. Okay, you can get the recording, whatever. He had an incredible upheaval in the Jewish world by claiming that he was Mashiach, claiming that he was the Son of God. He actually attracted vast amounts of support, as we talked about, and it was one of the defining moments of modern Jewish history, which really gave rise to many of the reverberations that we found in the 18th and 19th century. The fact that Shabtai Tzvi was proved to be a fraud, eventually converted to Islam. What's that? Completely discredited. However, there remained, and still remain, underground groups who believe that he still was the Messiah, and support that, etc. And there was something of a witch hunt in the 100 years after Shabtai Tzvi to try and out these people, just like we were talking about in Mashiach earlier, in the early days of Christianity, you never knew who davening next to you was an early Christian, was a min, was not a min. That's why they introduced the bracha olam al shinim, so that they could out these people, because these people wouldn't say that bracha. The same was true to some degree also at the time of Rav Yaakov Emden. So you didn't know who was a Sabbatean, and when they accused, we'll see, Rav Eibeshitz of being a Sabbatean, that was a very big thing. Again, a very different suggestion to Rav Nechemia Chayun. When did that first happen? So in the 1720s, he was accused of being a Sabbatean while still in Prague. Now, it didn't help that the Sabbateans also claimed that he was a Sabbatean. meaning there were known Sabbateans around. And they said, yes, absolutely, he's one of us. In fact, there was a point at which they claimed that he may be, Rav Eibeshitz, may be Mashiach ben David. Someone else took the role of Mashiach ben Yosef, and Mashiach ben David could be Rav Eibeshitz. And obviously, people didn't like hearing that. Again, this was only 60 years after Shabtai Tzvi. Rav Eibeshitz, of course, denied it. And he stood up on Yom Kippur and denounced the Sabbateans. He was one of the rabbis in Prague that made a cherem on the Sabbateans. But the suspicions never went away, even though most of the rabbis of the town found it incredible that Rabbi Yonatan Eibeshitz, a figure of that stature, could possibly be a Sabbatean. And therefore it kind of died down under the surface. He went to Prague. He became the chief rabbi, the dayan, not the chief rabbi, sorry. And then he became the Rav of Metz. And he became a Baal Shem, meaning he was the master of Kabbalah, and he started writing amulets. Now this was an important state. Many people may have amulets or know people who have amulets. My great-grandmother, Allah Shalom, had a little kamaya, which she always wore around her neck in a little gold encasement, which was all sorts of different names written on parchment or whatever, and people were very focused on the need for amulets and the use of amulets, and there was a number of women, a large number of women were dying at that time during childbirth. And therefore people turned to Rav Eibeshitz and said to him, you are the man, you can write the amulets to save these people, and therefore he wrote many of these protective amulets. And rumors began to abound that these amulets may indeed be proto-Sabbatean. Again, this was dismissed, and he said, this is nonsense, this is just the old rumors that are reviving again, and there's no truth in them at all. However, when he was eventually elected to be the rabbi of Kehilat Ahu, of Altona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek, people basically put his amulets under some kind of monitoring. And they said, listen, we've got to keep an eye on this. And they consulted with Rav Yaakov Emden. Now, Rav Yaakov Emden was not a rav in Altona. He had his own private shul. He had permission to have his own private shul, his own private printing press. He ran his own sort of fiefdom in Altona, but he was a major figure, and they consulted with him as to what these amulets really were. People began to suspect that these amulets may indeed be Sabbatean. Rav Eibeshitz denied it. When certain wording came out, he said, he claimed first that the wording didn't mean that, then he claimed that the wording, he didn't know what the wording meant because he copied it from another Baal Shem, and then he claimed that he didn't write it at all, which didn't make people confident. The drama really blew up in February 1751. There was a meeting on Tuesday, February the 2nd, where the lay leadership of Kehilat Ahu met with Rav Emden to discuss what are they going to do about this. Because Rav Emden at first refused to publicly come out against Rav Eibeshitz. He said it's not for him to oppose him. Whatever these amulets were, he doesn't know for sure that he wrote them, and therefore he won't make a public stance. But they had a meeting where they said something has to happen, and eventually a second meeting was called for that Thursday. Rav Emden got news that actually there was a threat to his life between these two meetings, and they decided he had to bring matters to a head. So there was a famous Thursday morning shacharis at Rav Emden's shtiebel, where he stood up and announced that Rav Eibeshitz, in fact, was a Sabbatean, that these amulets were written by him, that he read in the amulet in Atbash. Now, I don't know anything about amulets, but Atbash, of course, is when you read Aleph, Taf, and Shin, Fer, Bet, etc., etc. He claimed that in Atbash, one of the amulets actually said, Melech HaMashiach Shabtai Tzvi, and here's a copy of one of the amulets down here, if you can decipher it, then you can try that later on. You can get them. They were all notarized later, therefore you can find all the copies of them. And he stood up and he said, Rav Yonatan Eibeshitz is for sure a Sabbatean. The amulet is definitely heretical, and the Rav Eibeshitz has to be excommunicated. This is the chief rabbi. He basically stood up and said the chief rabbi has to be placed in cherem. Well, this obviously met with immediate response. The community reacted with horror. They actually made an announcement that Rav Emden's shul had to be closed down immediately, and they revoked his license. They then decreed that Rav Emden was in cherem. No one could speak to him for 4 weeks. No one could go to his services. His right to a printing press was pulled away from him by the Jewish community, which they couldn't actually do because it was given to him by the government. And he was ordered to leave, to get out of town within 6 months. Rav Emden's response was, nonsense. All those people who put me in cherem are themselves in cherem. I'm not going anywhere, and he rejected the whole thing. He was placed under house arrest by the Jewish community, but he managed to smuggle out three letters to major rabbinic figures at the time, the Pnei Yeshua, the chief rabbi of Metz, and also the chief rabbi of Amsterdam, and he recruited them in support. Basically, the matter would not die away. The amulets were notarized so that there could be no doubt as to whether they were true or not, and those notarizations were actually recently discovered in Geniza. But eventually, realizing that his life was in danger, Rav Emden was actually forced to flee, and he fled to Amsterdam, leaving his wife and family behind. The king of Denmark then stepped in. Okay? The Rav Emden appealed to the king of Denmark, who'd given him his right to a printing press, and the king judged in his favor after a very public trial in which all of the Jews' issues were tried in the non-Jewish courts and the non-Jewish press. This photo you have here, this picture on the top of page 5, is a print from a non-Jewish newspaper at the time of rabbis fighting over amulets. This is, again, from a non-Jewish newspaper. These rabbis are holding up amulets, and they were running stories about this, that the Jews are fighting over this, the Jews are fighting over that. Eventually, the king ruled in Rav Emden's favor, said he could have his shul back, said he could have his printing press back, but he forbade him from talking about it anymore. Nothing died down. The Eibeschitz camp basically continued to accuse him of publishing. His house was broken into on a Friday night. His papers were seized. Local police were called. There was a fight in the shul. One of the chazonim who was going to daven from the Amud was accused of being a Rav Yaakov Emden supporter, and they dragged him to the floor, punched him in the face, and eventually threw him out of shul. There was a fracas. The police had to be called. There was violence in the markets, in the fairs, in the cemeteries, in the synagogues, in private homes, and even on the floor of the Hamburg Stock Exchange, where the two sets of Jewish opponents began to fight it out. Now this was, you can imagine what kind of a Chilul Hashem this was. Eventually, things died down somewhat. Rav Eibeschitz was defended in the courts by one of his former students, who had actually then converted to Christianity, which didn't win him any more favors with the Emden camp. And eventually, Rav Eibeschitz was returned to his post as the Rav of Kiryat Ahu, and the dispute died down for some time. It unfortunately flared up again when some of the students in Rav Eibeschitz's yeshiva were outed as being real Sabbateans, and at the same time, Rav Eibeschitz's son announced that he himself was a Sabbatean Navi, a prophet, and joined the circles of Jacob Frank. So, this was a big mess, as you can hear. Just 100 years after the Shabtai Tzvi debacle, Rav Eibeschitz's yeshiva was closed down and never reopened. Eventually, when Rav Eibeschitz died, he was buried, of course, only a few graves away from where Rav Yaakov Emden was later buried. In retrospect, was Rav Eibeschitz a Sabbatean or was he not a Sabbatean? That is certainly not for us to judge at this stage. History has judged, Jewish history has judged both of these great people to be great people. We study the works of Rav Yaakov Emden, we study the works of Rav Yonasan Eibeschitz, we have their Sforim on our shelves, and you can ask different people what their views are. At the end of the day, this debate died down, but it didn't help, because it just added to the general feeling in the 1700s and early 1800s of anti-clerical feeling, anti-religious feeling. This was just another reason why people didn't want to get involved with rabbis and religion, etc., and just sowed the seeds of what became the Reform and the Haskalah. It didn't help at all. This was an age of revolution. Rav Yaakov Emden himself died just a few weeks before the American Declaration of Independence. Those two things are not related historically, but they are. It gives you a feel for the times. So this awful Chilul Hashem, very important fight, left its mark. Not in terms of the writings of the two Gedolim, but in terms of the effect that it had on people, on the Jewish world, etc. So Rav Yaakov Emden, who won that fight? I don't think anybody won that fight. But Rav Yaakov Emden would not back down, and that was his hallmark throughout the whole of his life. He wouldn't back down when he felt he was correct, even though that earned him many enemies, threats on his life, etc., etc. Leaving Rav Eibeschitz aside, let's look at some of the other things that Rav Emden talked about during his life. His investigations into Sabbatean philosophy took him into the Zohar, because a lot of the Sabbateans quoted extensively from the Zohar and claimed that that backed up their claims. So Rav Yaakov Emden, actually, in the Moruk Tzia, which were his comments on the Shulchan Aruch, he writes about the Zohar, words which today will be considered to be very controversial, maybe even heretical. The Zohar is now here to stay. Many parts of the Jewish world are very connected to the Zohar in the Sephardi world, in the world of Hasidus. You just have to look at the bonfires in Lag BaOmer. I actually had a personal story which was very interesting. A young man who was married to one of my students, they went back to Canada, that's right, and he left me some of his sforim. And he said, I'm not bothering to take these back to Canada, you can have them if you want. So they sat in my maksan for a couple of months, and then I went to look and see what they were. It was a complete set of the Zohar translated into English. I said to myself, oh, that's nice. I haven't got a Zohar translated into English. This will be a nice edition. It was like 15 volumes, very thick. But then I opened the first page, and it turned out that it was the English translation produced by the Kabbalah Center in California. So then I didn't know what to do about this, because the Kabbalah Center is not one of the authentic spokespeople, if you like, for real Kabbalah, by any means. So I asked the Shaila of a local senior posik in Yerushalayim as to what should I do with these sephorim, these books. And he told me, I won't say who it was, but he told me that I had to burn them. Burning books is not something that I'm particularly fond of, even though I did try a little bit, it's very hard. They seem to have some kind of a fireproof covering or whatever it was. I concluded that the only bonfire which will be big enough to burn this set of heretical Zohar would be the bonfires on Lag BaOmer. And the idea of throwing the Zohar onto the bonfire in Lag BaOmer was not one that I, because I'll be the next one to be thrown on the bonfire in Lag BaOmer. So I asked another Shiloh, another Paisik in Yerushalayim, and told him that I asked the first Shiloh and went through the whole process, and he recommended that I shouldn't try and burn anything, just stick them in a black garbage bag and throw them in the garbage, which is what I did, which was interesting. But the mental image of me standing at Lag BaOmer throwing bits of Zohar on the bonfire, even if it was from the Kabbalah Center, still gives me a smile, although it's not something I ever dared to do. But the views of Rav Yaakov Emden on the Zohar were not consistent with most people today. Look at what he writes. Look at number 4. I'm going to tell you, he says, anyone who is familiar with the Zohar will know. Clearly, it's not the case that Rav Shimon bar Yochai, he said, wrote everything that's in the Zohar. He didn't deny that Rav Shimon bar Yochai wrote some of the core elements of the Zohar, but not everything there is from Rav Shimon bar Yochai. Ach kalulu balul hu mikama chiburim. It's clearly made up of many different writings. Shechuvru bizman hagaonim, that were written in the times of the gaonim, ubedor sheachreim, and their generations following. Ulai b'yemei rabban and savorai. Maybe some of it dates back to late Talmudic times after the Amoraim by the Rebbe and Savorai. Chabur ha-sefer kodesh ahu. Meaning he does say that the sefer is kodesh, but it doesn't all come from Chazal. Kimat ein li safek b'davar zeh. I don't really have any question on this matter. V'gam yesh leida sheichnisu b'tocho dvarim harbe she'enu miguf ha-sefer klal. And there are all sorts of things that crept into this book which are clearly not meant to be there at all. Rak hagos ma'achronim. Okay, ma'od. Many views of later people. V'heimu rabu kamu rabu. Okay, there are many, many of these. V'uchel achriach lo chiach zeh. B'siyat et shema. I can prove it to you, he says. But moistim chotchim, I can prove it to you with clear proof. Okay? The chivati sefer lezev, a karatif mitpachat svarim. And I've written a whole sefer, he says, about the Zohar, shown to you that the Zohar is not actually entirely authentic, and he called that mitpachat svarim. Many were very, very against this. The chida, who we didn't get to speak about, but now we can do a little bit of tshuva and speak about it such, the chida rejected this and said it was kimat heretical to say that the Zohar was not entirely from Rav Shimon bar Yochai. But the Chasam Sofer actually supported the Yaivetz and calls him a Novi. He was a big person, even though the Chasam Sofer doesn't necessarily share all of his views. Nevertheless, the Yaivetz, Rav Yaakov Emden, also called the Yaivetz, Yaakov Ben Tzvi, his view on the Zohar remains a minority view, but an important view, and there were others that took this view, but it's, as I say, not very popular. His views on philosophy were even more controversial, if you like. Certainly in today's world. Philosophy was not in vogue by the time of Rabbi Yaakov Emden, although very much in the world of the Rambam and the Spanish rationalists, it was very much in vogue. So it was less controversial at the time that he said this about philosophy, but what he said was actually very interesting. Have a look at some of these quotes on page number 6, and we'll pick some of these things out. These are all from the workings of the Rav Yaakov Emden, from different places. The translation here is by Rav Schachter. Rav Schachter, as I said, who is an expert on Rav Yaakov Emden. He wrote a very good article in Tradition, and he has a number of these quotes from there. Let's pick out a few of these things that the Rav Yaakov Emden has to say about philosophy. Number 5, this was the very peg upon which evil was fixed throughout the entire period of the Second Commonwealth, Hanukkah time, whose turbulence did not rest from beginning to end. From it sprouted all the opposing sects who rivaled one another and were the cause of the war against Rome. Indeed, it was the accursed Greek wisdom, Chochmas Yavanes, which was the cause of our trouble, that destroyed the temple and despoiled the land of Israel. It was this that caused the dispersion of Jerusalem that was in Sepharad, quotes from Ovadia, Ovadia wasn't talking about Spain, but he's talking about Spain, to be expelled and uprooted from the country of Spain, where they'd been on a very high level of wealth and wisdom. They remained so until their hearts became arrogant, to exchange the horror of the honor of their dignified, my glasses are a bit better this week, but still a little bit not, the honor of their dignified, distinguished, rich and pleasant Torah, which gave birth to them, for the harlot, naked maidservant, which is philosophy. He blames philosophy for the Gerush Misfarad. That if it hadn't been for philosophy, the Sfaradim would not have suffered the fate that they suffered. Have a look, please, in number 7. It is with justification that our sages already prevented the study of Higayah, which, as I've written on occasions, is in Ir Elokit, which is one of his forum here, in Beth El and Ir Elokit, for it is very, very dangerous. Please note that the two great masters, Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra, who we also spoke about in this forum, and Maimonides, could not stand up against it with all the strength of their wisdom. They were not protected from the sword in its hand, for in their fleeing and escaping from the trap of anthropomorphism with all their strength, they utilized instruments of the study of philosophical logic. They became ensnared in the trap of the fowler, of the eternity of the world in which they stumbled and fell. Many fools did not understand their words and advice. For in truth, their intention was for good, the Ibn Ezra and the Rambam. For they were imbued with a different spirit. However, in the generation that came after them, they took their words literally and rejected the Torah in its entirety. This became for them a snare and an obstacle, a stumbling block for the household of Israel. And then he goes one stage further, and he denies that the Rambam actually even wrote the Morin Nebuchim. Because it can't be that the Rambam wrote the Morin Nebuchim. Look what it says in number 8. Maimonides was responsible for an obstacle for Jews, for he left over a stumbling stone for generations, the guide of the perplexed, as is well known. However, as for me, I do not think so. As I have revealed my opinion, this is not the work of the great author among the Jews, but one of the philosophers of his generation. He claims that the Morin Nebuchim was basically put in the Rambam's name, but was not written by him. Since he benefited the masses with his work, the Yad HaZakah, for this reason I cannot believe that he was responsible for the aforementioned sinful striking stone. He accomplished good for Israel with several books of his Talmudic works, in which he strengthens the pillars of the faith. Therefore he is remembered for good and for blessing for eternity, while the lawless, wicked ones who make of the Morin Nebuchim an axe to cut off the branches, to chop down the roots of providence, etc., will be an everlasting abhorrence. The name of the wicked shall rot. May God save us from them and any part of them. He doesn't leave you in any doubt. And he goes on in number 9 and number 10 to speak more about the same things. I'm not going to read it now. You can read it in your own time. He basically denies the Rambam wrote the Morin Nebuchim. Now, I think most people would say, even if they shared his views on philosophy, which some people may, I think they would say that he was wrong about the Rambam, that the Rambam definitely wrote the Morin Nebuchim. And now that we have works from the Cairo Geniza and various other manuscripts, I don't think there can be, as far as I'm aware, any doubt that the Rambam did write the Morin Nebuchim, but the Rav Yaakov Emden just could not bring himself to believe that because of who the Rambam was and about what the Morin Nebuchim did. And the Morin Nebuchim is still highly, highly marginalized and not really studied in certain parts of the world. And of course, in other parts of the world, the Rambam has become two characters, as is well known. He's the Rambam and he's Maimonides. Okay, and depending on who you ask, they claim who was the real one. You know, in the yeshiva world, the real one is the Rambam, and Maimonides is just, you know, writing for outreach or whatever. And in the academic world, Maimonides is the real one, and the Rambam is just writing the Yad HaZakah to prove his Jewish credentials to the to the Orthodox world. Of course, neither of these is true. The Rambam is one individual, and one has to understand him in that way. Now is not the time. Everybody claims him as theirs. He's Maimonides, not yours. But definitely we have to see him in a holistic way. Sorry about that rather poor joke. Rabbi Yaakov Emden wrote about Christianity. He wrote a letter called Seder Olam Rabba Vazuta. And he says some really fascinating things, which are, again, not in consonance with the way that people saw Christianity, especially coming out of the Middle Ages, given that all Christianity had done to the Jewish people. Look in number 11. Certainly, he says, there is no doubt the one who seeks full truth will agree with our thesis that the Nazarene and his apostles never meant to abolish the Torah of Moses from one who was born a Jew. Likewise, did Paul write in his letter to the Corinthians that each should adhere to the faith in which each was called. They therefore acted in accordance with the Torah by forbidding circumcision to the Gentiles, according to the Halakha, as it is forbidden to one who does not accept the yoke of the commandments. They knew that it would be too difficult for the Gentiles to observe the Torah of Moses. They therefore forbade them to circumcise, and it would suffice that they observe the 7 Noahide laws as commanded on them through the Halakha from Moses at Sinai. It is therefore a habitual saying of mine that the Nazarene brought about a double kindness in the world. On the one hand, he strengthened the Torah of Moses majestically, as mentioned earlier, and not one of our sages spoke out more emphatically concerning the immutability of the Torah. And on the other hand, he did much good for the Gentiles, provided they do not turn about his intent as they please, by doing away with idolatry and removing the images from their midst. He obligated them in the Sheva Mitzvah, so they should not be as the beasts of the field. He bestowed upon them ethical ways, and in this respect, he was much more stringent with them than the Torah of Moshe. Which is interesting as well. He goes on to talk about that. In the next paragraph, if certain Christians who consider themselves scholars would just understand this secret, who believe that they are commanded to abolish the Torah of Moses from the seed of Israel, they would not engage in such foolishness. The people listened to their self-conceived words, something which was never intended by the writers of the Gospels. Quite the opposite, they have written clearly that they intended the contrary. Because of these errant scholars, hatred has increased towards the Jews, who are blameless of any guilt and proceed innocently to observe their Torah with all their heart, imbued with the fear of God. They should instead bring their people to love the ancient children of Israel, who remain loyal to their God, as indeed commanded to Christians by their original teachers. This is an interesting forerunner of what now in the modern 21st century is the dual covenant theory that many modern day Christians have, after Nostra Aetate in 1965, etc., where they actually believe the Christians have one covenant and the Jews have a parallel covenant and the two maybe can live together. This was not at all thought in the 1700s, and yet Rav Yaakov Emden is remarkably, if you like, prescient in this, and he talks about this in this way. Needless to say, the comments that he makes about how the Nazarene has brought about a double kindness to the world did not go down too well with most people in the 1700s. But nevertheless, he insists on it and feels that Jews and Christians can actually live together if only the Christians would understand that their religion was not meant to attack the Jews, but complement the Jews. Now, in the shiur that I just gave this morning in the OU Israel Center, we actually had a completely opposite perspective on this, where we looked at the writings of the Toldos Yeshu, which was an early Jewish work, which I'm not sure if Rabbi Yaakov Emden ever comments on, where they actually suggest that it was the Jews who infiltrated the Christians in the early days to persuade the Christians to turn away from the Jews and to actually address their religion only to the non-Jewish Gentile world. It's an interesting topic as to whether that is historically correct or not, but nevertheless, Rabbi Yaakov Emden had some very unusual views on the matter. Even more radical, perhaps, if you look over to page 8, was his views on marriage and sexuality. One of the tshuvas, which is an enormous tshuva in the Yaivetz, in his second volume, in tshuva number 15, deals with the issue of the pilegesh. What is a pilegesh? A pilegesh is a woman who does not marry a man, but lives in a monogamous relationship with that man, and it basically has no kiddushin, and has no ksuba, and has no requirement for gittin, but has a kind of informal relationship where they might live alongside another wife, which is a real wife, if you like, with kiddushin, v'chupa, v'ksuba. But the pilegesh lives in this kind of informal but monogamous relationship. Now, we have not had pilegshim in the Jewish world for millennia. Clearly, in the Tanakh, there were pilegshim, and the kings had Pilagshim. The question is, did other people? Well, Avram Avinu talks about the Pilagshim, etc. But this never really found its way beyond the Tanakh. We never hear of anyone in Chazal who recommended having Pilagshim. We never even hear of anyone who had more than one wife. The idea of having two wives was, even though technically permitted, was definitely seen as being a very negative thing. Just go through Tanakh and find any single incident of two wives leading to a happy shalom bayis situation. Clearly, the Tanakh is telling you that even if it's technically permitted, it's bad news. But Pilagshim we certainly don't find. And then when we get to Rabbeinu Gershom, in the early 1000s, etc., he actually prohibits polygamy completely by the Cherem of Rabbeinu Gershom. So the Rav Yaakov Emden in the 1700s picks up on this and says, you know something? I think all of this is wrong. It's just all wrong. He says there is no reason why, in principle, a person cannot have a pilegesh today. He says, actually, that the Cherem of Rabbeinu Gershom was completely misconceived. It was probably in breach of being chukat hagoy, because Rabbeinu Gershom was influenced by the Christians at the time who felt bigamy was obviously a sin, and he said there's no reason why he should think that way other than he's influenced by non-Jews. He said the prohibition on having a second wife, it actually was a michshol, it was an improper measure and a stumbling block, and anyway, he says, it wasn't accepted by most people, only by the Jews of Central Europe, not by Western Europe and not by the East. And anyway, he said the whole Rabbeinu Gershom Cherem expired in 1240. So forget about it, he said. On the contrary, he feels that the concept of Pilagshim would be helpful in society, he writes, as long as they are monogamous, as long as it's not some kind of hefka relationship, as long as they observe the laws of Tarat HaMishpacha. He actually thinks it would be a very positive thing, because he looks around him in the 1700s and says there's a great deal of promiscuity in the Jewish world. And Pilagshim, this is not a modern phenomenon, the Pilagshim, he said, would solve much of that. It would help our sexual morality, promote pru revu, and avoid promiscuity. This is also partly connected with Sabbatean philosophy, because one of the things that they did as part of this underground Sabbatean movement is they did a lot of wife swapping. That was part of the Sabbatean philosophy to bring Kedusha to the sparks, which they said were in adultery, etc. And obviously, the Rav Yaakov Emden was absolutely horrified at this and says that if this is what's going on, maybe Pilagshim are a good idea. The problem, of course, halachically, is he has to deal with all of the Rishonim who say that it's prohibited. And one by one, he takes them on. The Rambam, the Ravid, the Radvaz, the Rivash, he deals with all of their arguments and he disagrees with every single one of them. At the end, he says, however, I recommend before you take a pilegesh, maybe you should check with the other rabbonim of the time, because I don't want to be responsible on my own for this innovation. But in principle, he thinks it was a very, very good idea. Needless to say, this did not catch on, and anyone who pokes their head above the parapet these days and even mentions the concept that maybe Pilagshim is not prohibited in Halacha gets shot down very quickly. There was a fellow in Meir Sha'arim that produced a kuntras some years ago, basically picking up these arguments, and he circulated around Geula Meir Sha'arim. I think the guy, they called in the local sneers police, and the guy was quietened down in a way that persuaded him that he wasn't going to do that anymore. And certainly no serious posek today would recommend this, but this was Rav Yaakov Emden's approach. Interestingly, yes.
Did he take one himself?
No, absolutely not. He himself was extremely sexually chaste, even though he writes, we'll see in a minute, about his temptations in his autobiography. He certainly did not do that. He had a wife and she died. He took a second wife, she died, he took a third wife. He had a number of children, many of them died, but he was very into marriage, and he was very into pru revu, but under no circumstances did he do that himself. He does write a great detail, and amazingly, beautifully, but very graphically, in his siddur about the mitzvah of pru revu on Friday night between husband and wife, and he goes through in great detail explaining how this is to be done and the ways to do it, the Kedusha. And in this sense, he felt, again, he had his own printing press. He didn't have to go to Koren to, or Magid or whatever to get permission. So he published whatever he wanted, but he writes very beautifully there, but quite surprisingly and not very rabbinic in the way you'd expect that to be. Having said which, let's talk now about the last thing, which is Megillat Sefer. Megillat Sefer, which is his autobiography, is fascinating. It's just no holds barred. He holds nothing back at all. And he obviously is writing this autobiography to justify his own position against the people that he opposed, against Rav Yonatan Eibeshitz, to justify the fact that he's not as difficult as people make him out to be. He writes frequently that during his time in Emden, as the Rav in Emden, everybody loved him and everything was fine, so there's obviously nothing wrong with him. It's other people that are the problem. But he writes a lot of things about his own life that you would not expect him to write. First of all, the first 50, 60 pages deal with his father's life. It's really a biography of the Chacham Tzvi. And he deals with that in a lot of detail. He was very close to his father, felt very strongly that his father had been badly treated. We talked about that last week. When dealing with his own life, I've just brought a few things here in which he is shockingly unrestrained. First of all, he talks about his own personal illnesses with really, you know, too much information that you'd really want about the different things that happened to him and how he remedied them and his problems of different types in different parts of his body. He goes through all of the details on how he dealt with it, how he lived with it, and how he solved it and cured it. So that's actually fascinating. He talks about how when he was a young man, he actually fell in love with another woman that he felt would be highly suitable for him, and how they really wanted to marry, and how he couldn't persuade his father to make the shidduch, and how it disappointed him, but how in the end it worked out okay because this young woman married someone else, and when she was a widow, she helped him to get the job in Emden, so they kept in contact, but he said this was a great loss to him that he never married the woman that he loved at the beginning of his life, and the woman that he did marry, it turned out to be a complete, you know, a disaster at the beginning and just nagged him and was annoyed with him and upset with him, and probably he was difficult with her, whatever. He talks about that as well. I mentioned his relationship with his father-in-law, who, as I said, he claimed stole some of his wedding presents. He writes shockingly later in life when he was on his own about a forward young cousin that actually tempted him. I brought this because it's in his book, so it's in the public domain, but have a look in number 10 at the bottom here in this footnote. I read here in Prague, he writes, I experienced a challenge similar to that of the biblical saintly Joseph. In fact, mine was somewhat more challenging. I was then a passionate young individual who had been separated from his spouse for a considerable period. I therefore longed for female company, which I had the opportunity of fulfilling in the person of a lovely young lady, viz. My cousin, who kept me company and who was audacious enough to evince a special affection for me. In fact, she almost embraced me. Indeed, when I was resting in my bed, she came to see if I was well covered. In other words, she wanted me to embrace her. Had I yielded to my baser instincts, he writes, she would not have denied me anything. On several occasions, I almost succumbed, just as a flame is attracted to stubble, but the Almighty granted me strong willpower, as well as an abundance of dignity and courage to prevail over my burning passions. Not what you expect from a rabbinic autobiography. He writes about the rabbis who occupied the position that his father used to occupy at Gehillat Ahu, and he vilifies them. One of them, of course, was Rabbi Yonatan Eibeshitz, who he has absolutely no time for at all, but prior to that was Rabbi Chezkel Katzen Ellenbogen, who was a chief rabbi there, and who he writes, and I brought down just one comment. I brought the one that was least personally offensive against him, number 11, Rav Yaakov Emden writes, what can we say about the study of his novellae, his Kiddushim, his interpretations and his sermons, which literally leads to farce and mockery. It is incredible to relate all the absurdities, nonsense, imaginations, hallucinations and foolishness. All who heard them were forced to burst forth in laughter. Any knowledgeable, understanding reader will be stunned by his decisions and rulings as demonstrated in writing. You know, he didn't like his works, and then he writes about him in person. It's a question as to how does Lashon Hara deal with all of this? How do you write about people, and does Lashon Hara apply after people have died? It's interesting. This question came up more recently when Rav Nosson Kamenetsky brought out The Making of a Godel, which was banned because of its very open discussion of the lives of Gedolim of the late 19th, early 20th century, and the reason he wrote it, of course, was to show how they overcame those challenges in their youth and became the people that they became, but people claimed that it was not acceptable, Lashon Hara, etc. The real defense is that Lashon Hara doesn't work the same way after a person's died as it does when they're alive, but nevertheless, he holds nothing back, and he criticizes him in other places in even more personal detail. And of course, Rabbi Yosef Eibeshitz is dealt with in great detail. So, Rabbi Yaakov Emden, don't be under the impression that all he did in his life was create controversy. That's not true. He created a lot of very important works of halacha and Jewish thought, and his writings are very mainstream in that sense. But in the areas that we've talked about, whether it's his opinions on the Zohar, his views on the Rambam, the Mora Nevuchim, his views on Christianity, his views on marriage and Pelagshim, or his own autobiography, he was one and unique. I can't think of anyone like him in history, in the Jewish world, and therefore if he's one of your illustrious forebears, then you can be proud, but nevertheless, Kanai ben Kanai does lead you into some personal issues, and maybe is not the bay for most people to go. Okay, that terminates our discussion here. Wish you all a great week, and see you soon.